Chapter 7, Project Paperclip and the Space Race. On May 19, 1945, just 12 days after Germany's unconditional surrender, Herbert Wagner, creator of the first Nazi-guided missile used in combat, landed in Washington, D.C. in a U.S. military aircraft with blacked-out windows. Wagner was the first of a stream of Nazi scientists, technicians, and others to arrive in the United States in a program that came to be known as Project Paperclip. It began as Operation Overcast, a program authorized by the Joint Chiefs of Staff to exploit the knowledge of Nazi scientists. Overcast was mentioned but not clearly explained in the 2006 film The Good German, starring George Clooney. This operation was renamed Paperclip and formally authorized in August 1945 by President Harry Truman, who was assured that no one with Nazi or militaristic records would be involved. By mid-November, more Nazi scientists, engineers, and technicians were arriving in America, including Werner von Braun and more than 700 other Nazi rocket scientists. By 1955, nearly 1,000 German scientists had been granted citizenship in the United States and given prominent positions in the American scientific community. Many had been longtime members of the Nazi Party and the Gestapo and conducted experiments on humans at concentration camps, used slave labor, and committed other war crimes. Von Braun, who in later years became the head of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, NASA, is one of the more recognizable names of the paperclip scientists. Others included Major General Walter Dornberger, a close associate of von Braun's, Werner Heisenberg, physicist and Nobel laureate who founded quantum mechanics, gaseous uranium centrifuge expert Dr. Paul Hartek, Nazi atomic bomb physicist and military project leader Kurt Diebner, uranium enrichment expert Erich Braga, 1944 Nobel Prize winner Otto Hahn, called the father of nuclear chemistry, scientists Carl Friedrich von Weizsäcker, Karl Wirtz, and Horst Korsching, and physicist Walter Gerlach. CNN reporter Linda Hunt's 1991 book, Secret Agenda, The United States Government, Nazi Scientists, and Project Paperclip, 1945 to 1990, first revealed the extent to which Nazi infiltration was aided by persons within the U.S. federal government and military. Like other researchers, Hunt found many government files pertaining to recruited Nazis missing or otherwise unavailable. Despite government claims that Paperclip was ended in 1947, according to Hunt, this project was the biggest, longest-running operation involving Nazis in our country's history. The project continued non-stop until 1973, decades longer than was previously thought. And remnants of it are still in operation today, she wrote. By the 1990s, when details of Paperclip finally reached the public's ears, the infusion of Nazis into America's military-industrial complex was complete. In 1952, newly elected President Dwight D. Eisenhower was persuaded to name John Foster Dulles as his Secretary of State and his brother, Allen Dulles, as the director of the CIA. The reigning Dulles brothers were the Republican replacements for their client and business partner, Democrat Averell Harriman. Occasional public posturing aside, their strategic commitments to the globalists were identical to his, stated authors Webster Griffin Tarpley and Anton Chaitkin in their well-documented 1992 unauthorized biography of George H.W. Bush. It should be noted that the Dulles brothers were both attorneys for and business partners with Averell Harriman. It should also be noted that Allen Dulles, as OSS station chief in Bern, Switzerland, sat at the nexus of U.S. intelligence as well as Soviet intelligence, such as the infamous Rote Kapelle, or Red Orchestra spy network. It was during his stint as assistant to the U.S. ambassador that Dulles used SS Brigadeführer, or Brigadier General, Walter Schellenberg, to communicate with his immediate superior, Reichsführer Heinrich Himmler. Dulles constantly sent intelligence reports to Washington, although, as stated by Adam Labore, there are questions as to whether his motive was supplying genuine economic intelligence or merely building a complicated empire of information and disinformation that reached from Bern to Berlin and back again. Dulles moved from Bern to become OSS station chief in Berlin at the end of the war. In 1947, when the OSS was rolled into the newly created CIA, Dulles' translator was an Army intelligence officer named Henry Kissinger, who would go on to become Secretary of State under President Richard Nixon, a lifelong friend to Dulles. Project Paperclip quickly came under the control of an old boy network encompassing members of the globalists centered in the Council on Foreign Relations. After its inception, Paperclip was run by the Intelligence Division of the U.S. Army's European Command, directed by Robert Walsh, operating out of Berlin. The Paperclip office operated out of the Intelligence Division's headquarters in Heidelberg under Deputy Director Colonel Robert Schau, who would become Assistant Director of the CIA in 1949 and Assistant Chief of Staff for Intelligence in 1956, Hunt wrote in Secret Agenda. She added that officers of the Joint Intelligence Objectives Agency, JIOA, who managed Project Paperclip, soon began receiving security reports from Schau's office regarding the Germans recruited into the program. All reports on these men had been altered from a determination of ardent Nazi to read not an ardent Nazi. After assuming the directorship of the newly created CIA, Alan Dulles, who, as attorney for the Schroeder Bank, had brokered the deals allowing Hitler's rise to power, assumed control over Project Paperclip, and increased the flow of National Socialists into the United States. After former Nazi spymaster General Reinhard Gehlen met with the CIA director Dulles and offered to turn over his extensive spy network to the CIA in exchange for non-prosecution of their Nazi pasts, the scientists' dossiers were rewritten to eliminate incriminating evidence of their work for the Nazis. For over 40 years, Paperclip's dark secrets lay safely hidden in cover-ups, lies, and deceit, stated Hunt. Hunt uncovered documents showing that even Wernher von Braun, who in 1947 had been described as a potential security threat by the military governor, was reassessed only months later in a report stating he may not constitute a security threat to the U.S. Likewise, von Braun's brother, Magnus, who had been declared a dangerous German Nazi by counterintelligence officers, was brought to America and his pro-Nazi record expunged. The effects of the cover-up involved far more than merely whitewashing the information in the dossiers, noted Hunt. Serious allegations of crimes not only were expunged from the records, but were never even investigated. In a 1985 exposé in the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, Hunt wrote that she had examined more than 130 reports on Project Paperclip subjects, and every one had been changed to eliminate the security threat classification. President Truman, who had explicitly ordered no committed Nazis to be admitted under Project Paperclip, was evidently never aware that his directive had been violated. Again, this is evidence of control at a level higher than the president. By the late 1940s, the now-ascendant Cold War added new impetus. Potential intelligence assets were recruited from all across Europe, many of them zealous Nazis who could be relied upon to be anti-communists. In an effort to avoid the negative publicity that had burdened some of the early paperclip activities, some Americans just did not think it proper to bring former Nazis to the United States and place them in responsible positions, JIOA officers began bringing Nazis from Argentina, that haven for the Bormann organization. According to Hunt, all of this activity was almost totally unknown to the public, but rested in the hands of certain top-ranking government officials like the Dulles brothers and John J. McCloy. The agenda of the globalists was moving ahead. Paperclip had several spin-off projects. Expanding on Paperclip, the National Interest Program was tightly connected to the new CIA and provided a means of bypassing close scrutiny by anti-Nazi elements within military intelligence. No longer were Nazi scientists the sole objective. Recruitment of Nazis now included Eastern Europeans thought to be helpful against the communists and even convicted Nazi war criminals. Anyone, regardless of their past, was eligible as long as someone within the U.S. government deemed their presence in the national interest. Linda Hunt wrote, "Prevailing myth has it that the first group in national interest, the German scientists, were employed solely because of their scientific expertise, but there were other reasons as well. First, defense contractors and universities could hire German scientists for substantially less money than they could American employees. Salary statistics show that the Germans signed contracts for approximately $2,000 a year less than their American counterparts received in comparable positions. Of course, the Germans were unaware of the salary discrepancy since they had earned even less money in West Germany. The JIOA, however, took advantage of the situation by promoting cheap salaries to convince corporations to participate in the project. Second, because of the Joint Chiefs of Staff connection with the National Interest Project, German scientists could obtain necessary security clearances more easily than could American scientists. Defense contractors looking for new employees to work on classified projects found this aspect of national interest to be particularly advantageous. By 1957, more than 60 companies were listed on JIOA's rosters, including Lockheed, W.R. Grace & Company, CBS Laboratories, and Martin Marietta. National interest placed German scientists at major universities in research or teaching positions, regardless of their Nazi pasts. Even the U.S. Office of Education helped JIOA send flyers to universities all over the country, touting the advantages of hiring the Germans on federally financed research projects, since they could obtain security clearances more easily than Americans. The University of Texas, Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis, Missouri, and Boston University were among the participants. It should be noted that Yale University, alma mater of the Bush and Harriman families and home of Skull and Bones, also received paperclip Nazis as employees. Another program, codenamed simply Project 63, was designed specifically to get German scientists out of Europe and away from the Soviets. Most went to work for universities or defense contractors, not the U.S. government, noted Hunt. Thus, the American taxpayer footed the bill for a project to help former Nazis obtain jobs within Lockheed, Martin Marietta, North American Aviation, and other defense contractors during a time when many American engineers in the aircraft industry were being laid off. The Project 63 effort to import Nazis grew so public. In 1952, JIOA Deputy Director Air Force Colonel Gerald Crabb and a gaggle of military officers, paperclip members, and civilians journeyed to West Germany on a recruitment drive that even McCloy expressed concern over a violent reaction by West German officials. West Germans complained to U.S. Ambassador James Conant, demanding that paperclip be ended. Conant appealed to then-Secretary of State John Foster Dulles to shut down Paperclip before we are faced with a formal complaint by the West German government against a continuing U.S. recruitment program which has no parallel in any other Allied country. But the project was not stopped. As usual, there was simply a name change. Paperclip became the Defense Scientists Immigration Program, DEFSIP. Conant may not have realized his appeal was aimed at one of the architects of the very program he was trying to end. As the paperclip project began to lose momentum, yet another stimulus arose. On October 4, 1957, the Russians launched Sputnik 1 into orbit around the Earth, and the space race was on. The Nazi scientists were in demand more than ever. Paperclip began to grow. Specialists were imported from Germany, Austria, and other countries under Project 63 and national interest, and gained positions at many universities and defense contractors, including Duke University, RCA, Bell Laboratories, Douglas Aircraft, and Martin Marietta. Information about the number of defectors and other individuals brought in by the CIA and military intelligence agencies is unknown, since JIOA records concerning them were either shredded or pulled during the FBI's investigation in 1964, noted Hunt, adding, "It had taken the greatest war in history to put a stop to an unspeakable evil, and now the cutting edge of that nightmare was being transplanted to America." Interestingly, even as we were bringing foreign defectors into the USA, we discovered a traitor within our own government. Lieutenant Colonel William Henry Whalen, who from 1957 served as Deputy Director of JIOA, the agency that commanded Paperclip, became the highest-ranking American ever recruited as a mole by the Soviet Intelligence Service. Only 4 months after he began spying for the Soviets, Whalen was promoted to the directorship of JIOA. When arrested in 1962, Whalen was an intelligence advisor, which permitted him access to any information pertaining to the Joint Chiefs of Staff planning and allocation of military forces, including communications and electronic intelligence gathering. Whalen, who suffered from alcoholism and debt, was recruited by the Soviets in the mid-1950s by Colonel Sergei Edemsky, a loquacious Soviet military attaché in Washington, D.C. Although it became publicly known that Whalen admitted providing the communists with our utmost secrets concerning U.S. nuclear weaponry and strategies, his connection with Paperclip was not revealed. Yet, author Hunt raised a relevant question about Whalen by asking, did he use blackmail to recruit a spy or saboteur from among the approximately 1,600 paperclip specialists and hundreds of other JIOA recruits brought to this country since 1945? It certainly is clear from the evidence that many of them had a lot to hide. Though charged with espionage, in 1966, Whalen made a deal with the Justice Department in which he pled guilty to a lesser charge in exchange for his cooperation. Federal Judge Orrin Lewis, while accusing Whalen of selling me and all your fellow Americans down the river, nevertheless sentenced the spy to a mere 15 years in prison. He was paroled after serving only 6 years. But it was not just homegrown spies like Whalen who were slipping information out of Paperclip. Imported Nazis had every opportunity to pass national security information out of the country. According to Hunt, there was no further army surveillance over the Nazi paperclip specialists after just 4 months of their signing a contract with the U.S. government. Furthermore, anyone receiving any more than 50% support from a paperclip specialist constituted a dependent, according to their contracts. The large number of so-called dependents, including mistresses and maids, brought to Fort Bliss, Texas, as a result of this situation, were subject to no off-the-post surveillance, even though it was assumed that they had access to at least some classified information because of their close contact with paperclip personnel, wrote Hunt. Incidents of information being passed out of paperclip were presented to authorities, yet nothing was done. A Fort Bliss businessman reported paperclip engineer Hans Lindenmeyer to the FBI, claiming the German had been using his business address as an illegal letter drop. According to Hunt, at least three other Nazis maintained illegal mail drops in El Paso, where they received money from foreign or unknown sources and coded messages from South America. It was also learned that many paperclip Nazis received cash from foreign sources. Neither Army CIC nor FBI agents knew where that money came from, and by all appearances, no one cared to know how more than a third of the paperclip group suddenly were able to buy expensive cars, noted Hunt. When word was passed that Nazi scientists working for the French were suspected of receiving orders from Germany to work toward a reemergence of the Reich, Army intelligence officers finally began to take a closer look at paperclip. Amazingly, the biggest catch was Wernher von Braun. It was revealed that at the end of the war, the rocket scientist had been caught sending a map overseas to General Dornberger and concealing information from U.S. officials. Further investigation revealed that paperclip specialists were allowed to make unsupervised trips off base and even out of town, the only requirement being that they report when they arrived at their destination. Several had their own telephones that were never monitored. President Truman was once notified by the CIA that the Nazi scientists working for the Soviets were using a postal address in the U.S. sector of West Germany as a cover for communications with the paperclip scientists in America. One General Electric manager working with paperclip scientists told the FBI that the Army's lax security at White Sands Proving Grounds bordered on criminal neglect, especially since about 350 of the Germans' former co-workers were serving the Russians. He believed that it was reasonable to assume that friendly contacts between the two groups still existed. Apparently, overseas communication between the Nazis in America and the Nazis in Russia continued unabated, which has raised the possibility of a parallel space race controlled or manipulated by the very globalists who had created and financed both communism and the Third Reich. Almost everyone who was of age in 1969 recalls vividly the pride and excitement of the U.S. Apollo mission's moon landing on July 20th. It is difficult, then, for them to seriously consider the many contradictions and anomalies of the six moon landings. What may be even more difficult is to consider that the space race was never a true competition between the United States and the former Soviet Union. Rather, it was a combined space program run by Nazi scientists and controlled by high-level globalists. As the Allies closed in on Nazi Germany in the spring of 1945, top American commanders were given orders to leave all the rockets and their plans at the Nazi facility at Nordhausen for the Russians. However, some commanders unofficially absconded with about 100 V-2s, along with a large collection of plans, manuals, and other documents. According to one American officer, "We gave the Russians the key to Sputnik." For 10 weeks, the American Army had in its hands the rocket plant that gave the Russians their head start in the missile race. Here was more evidence of the collusion taking place at the high level of the globalists who were already directing activities that would lead to the Cold War. After the war, at NASA's George C. Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama, the Nazi rocket scientists established nearly a carbon copy of their organization at the wartime secret Nazi rocket facility at Peenemünde. According to Linda Hunt, James Webb, NASA administrator during the Kennedy years, complained that the Nazi scientists were circumventing the system to the extent of attempting to build their own Saturn V rocket in-house at the Marshall Center. The Germans dominated the rocket program to such an extent that they held the chief and deputy slots of every major division and laboratory. And their positions at Marshall and the Kennedy Space Center at Cape Canaveral, Florida, were similar to those they had held during the war, wrote Hunt. The Peenemünde team's leader, Wernher von Braun, became the first director of the Marshall Space Center. Mittelwerk's head of production, Arthur Rudolph, was named project director of the Saturn V rocket program. Peenemünde's V-2 flight test director, Kurt Diebus, was the first director of the Kennedy Space Center. Rudolph, who gained American citizenship after entering the USA with his boss, von Braun, under the program that was to become Paperclip, was credited with helping to place Americans on the moon. He retired with a NASA pension in 1979, but was stripped of his American citizenship in 1983 after he conceded to the Justice Department that he had participated under the direction of and on behalf of the Nazi government of Germany in the persecution of unarmed civilians because of their race, religion, national origin, or political opinion. However, a West German investigation of Rudolph stated there was no factual basis for charging him with war crimes and granted him German citizenship. several Americans, including Lieutenant Colonel William E. Winterstein, Sr., who was commander of the Technical Service Unit at Fort Bliss, Texas, which supported the German scientists, claimed Rudolph was railroaded by the Justice Department's Office of Special Investigations, some members of which had the full cooperation of the Soviet Union. Therefore, close coordination with the KGB. As recently released files from behind the Iron Curtain have revealed, many of the scientists in Paperclip, as well as some on the Manhattan Project, indeed were spying for the Soviet Union. Their motivations were many. Some spied for pay, some for ideology, but all were manipulated by intelligence chiefs far above them. The flow of information between the scientists in the Soviet Union and the United States has led some researchers to suspect that a covert space program, a third program, was in effect. Joseph P. Farrell, who holds a doctorate degree in patristics, the study of early Christian writers and their work, from the University of Oxford, also has researched ancient history and physics to include the space program. In his 2004 book, Reich of the Black Sun, Farrell wrote, "It is perhaps significant that some contemporary observers of the American space program and its odd 30-year-long holding pattern and tapestry of inconsistencies, lies, and obfuscations have long suspected that there are indeed two space programs inside the U.S. government, the public NASA one and the quasi-independent one based deep within covert and black projects." This idea is somewhat supported by the fact that the space programs of Russia and America moved along different paths. At the start, the Russians proved more capable of attaining spaceflight than the Americans. Under the leadership of their brilliant engineer, Sergei Korolev, the Russians produced giant heavy-lift rockets, while their American counterparts were busy developing the internal technology for guidance and control. The Soviet Russians were first to launch a satellite, Sputnik, into Earth's orbit, 1957. To orbit a man, Colonel Yuri Gagarin, and return him safely, 1961. To place a live animal, the dog Laika, 1957, and Valentina Tereshkova, the first woman, into orbit, 1963. To land unmanned vehicles on the moon, 1970. To conduct an extravehicular spacewalk by cosmonauts, and to place nuclear warheads on intercontinental ballistic missiles, ICBM. Both nations used captured Nazi V-2 rockets to begin their space programs. A common joke in the 1950s involved an argument between a Russian and an American. "Our German scientists are better than your German scientists," they shouted at each other. Yet the evidence indicates that the American rocket scientists were indeed placed into a holding pattern, while their Soviet counterparts caught up with their technology. William E. Winterstein, Sr., a retired U.S. Army lieutenant colonel and one of the rocket engineers on NASA's Apollo team, noted in his 2002 book, Gestapo, USA, "The space history of this country reveals that during the 1950s, the von Braun team had developed a multi-stage rocket by adding solid propellant rocket stages to a Redstone rocket as booster. In 1956, such a rocket with two solid stages made successful high-speed rocket re-entry tests with model warheads covered with ablative heat protection. With three solid stages, such a rocket could have placed a satellite into orbit more than a year before the U.S. was defeated by Sputnik. However, and almost unbelievably, the von Braun team was given direct orders from Washington to stop further development. The team was restricted to the development of rockets whose range was less than 200 miles. It was only after President Kennedy announced the lunar mission in 1961 that the German rocket team was finally released from agonizing bureaucratic blunders from Washington and was given a free hand, and even orders, to accomplish von Braun's lifelong goal to travel into space. It has been argued that a primary incentive of the German scientists was the sheer desire to continue their work. Some of these would stop at nothing, even resorting to duping their colleagues and superiors in order to ensure the continuance of their research, commented British authors Mary Bennett and David S. Percy. However, in some cases, such as that of von Braun, the connection between the work and the Nazi was close and continuous. Von Braun, the son of a well-connected Prussian minister who founded the German Savings Bank, was brought into Germany's rocket program by Luftwaffe General Walter Dornberger, who, although charged as a war criminal for the rocket attacks on London and Antwerp, was never brought to trial. Instead, he came into the United States as part of Project Paperclip. Likewise, von Braun, revered as the father of the U.S. space program, was found to have been a Nazi party member, a member of the SS with the rank of Major, a friend to SS Reichsfuhrer Heinrich Himmler, and, according to Linda Hunt, was accused by survivors of the rocket factories at Mittelwerk and Peenemünde of at least once ordering the execution of slave laborers. Kurt Diebus, who became the first director of the Kennedy Space Center at Cape Canaveral, was both a member of the Nazi SS and the SA. According to documents obtained by Hunt, in 1942, Diebus turned a colleague over to the Gestapo for making anti-Hitler remarks. The Soviet manner of dealing with their Nazi scientists greatly differed from the laxity of Project Paperclip. With hindsight, it would seem that the Soviets demonstrated a more humanitarian approach toward their technical prisoners than did the Americans, noted Bennett and Percy. Moreover, the way in which the technical information was passed from teacher to pupil was very different. The Soviet experts and the Germans worked side by side in the same factory, but in separate areas. Information was passed between these teams without the Germans ever meeting their Soviet counterparts. They only spoke directly to Korolev, who was far curter with them than he had been in Bleicherode, the V-2 test area in Germany's Harz Mountains, where Korolev had first debriefed the scientists at war's end. Some serious researchers have opined that the space programs of both the USSR and the USA, despite the political posturing, were actually the same program, one far ahead of the current joint Russian-American space efforts, such as the International Space Station. This overall project was conceived and designed as a collaboration between two superpowers, wrote Bennett and Percy. The Cold War was a convenient cover under which aspects of this program could be implemented and hidden. All these machinations were orchestrated at the very highest level, with only a select and hidden few ever knowing the overall objectives of the project. As noted by Farrell, this of course implies some entity or agency of coordination existing both within the Soviet Union and the United States. If this were so, who were these hidden manipulators? To begin with, there were the German rocket scientists themselves. In 1945, Lieutenant Walter Jessel was assigned to investigate how much trust to give the scientists before bringing them to America. According to author Hunt, the lieutenant uncovered evidence of a conspiracy among von Braun, Dornberger, and Dornberger's former chief of staff, Herbert Axter, to withhold information from U.S. officers. Secret codicils within the 1945 Yalta Agreement between Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin allowed for the partitioning of Europe between the Allied powers. Dr. Wilhelm Voss, the former head of the Skoda Munitions Works in Pilsen, had handled much of the material for Kammler's Kammlerstab Special Projects Group. In May 1945, when elements of the American Army arrived in the Czech city of Pilsen, Voss attempted to hand over a truckload of Kammlerstab documents, but was told by the commanding U.S. officer that he was under orders to give everything to the Russians. While entire German divisions were trying desperately to surrender to the Western Allies, it is well known that Patton's Third Army had reached the outskirts of Berlin before being ordered back 100 miles to await the arrival of the Russians, who were required to fight desperately for every block of the city. Such a withdrawal is clear evidence of the deals being made at the highest levels. As has been noted, there was communication between the two groups of Nazi scientists, even though they were half a world away from each other. This could have been facilitated by the interconnected business and banking interests already described. As detailed in the section Communism versus National Socialism, the same Western bankers and financiers who funded Hitler's National Socialism also supported communism in Russia. The U.S. federal government's leniency toward communism has been well documented, beginning with President Franklin D. Roosevelt, who began his career as a Wall Street attorney specializing in corporate law. Roosevelt echoed his Wall Street cronies' warm regard for both Stalin and communism. According to historian Thomas Fleming, the U.S. government was rife with globalist agents conveying secrets back to Russia. There was scarcely a branch of the American government, including the War, Navy, and Justice Departments, that did not have Soviet moles in high places, feeding Moscow information. William Wild Bill Donovan's Office of Strategic Services, the forerunner of the CIA, had so many informers in its ranks, it was almost an arm of the NKVD. Donovan's personal assistant, Duncan Chaplin Lee, was a spy, Fleming wrote. Another possible crossing point for aerospace information may have been the British Interplanetary Society, BIS, according to Bennett and Percy. While the BIS was reportedly created in September 1945 by combining several existing organizations interested in the future of space exploration, it was not officially inaugurated until December of that year. At that time, Wernher von Braun, the man behind the V-2 rockets, was named as an honorary fellow. Arthur C. Clarke, an early member of the BIS, claimed the society had been in existence long before the war and was merely in suspended animation from 1939 to 1945. Noting that the Soviet embassy in London subscribed to no less than 20 copies of the bi-monthly BIS journal, Bennett and Percy asked, why was it necessary to reform a society already in existence? Why did the British hasten to grant such an award to a man who only 9 months before, as technical director of the Nazi V-1 and V-2 rocket programs, was responsible for the annihilation of so many people in London and the home counties? Why did both the British and von Braun wish to play down the real timing if everybody felt comfortable with the reasons for honoring von Braun? Their insinuation is that valuable rocket technology information was passed along via the BIS, possibly with the approval of von Braun.